Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we're going to delve into long COVID, what it's like having it and what it's like treating it. We'll also talk to Ramon Ramos Alayo of the Cuba Caribe Dance Festival. But first, we're pleased to be joined tonight by San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie to talk about his new plan on homelessness. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Mayor Lurie.
Thank you, Ethan. It's good to be with you.
So, Mayor Lurie, last week you signed an executive directive and announced a new plan to address homelessness called Breaking the Cycle, with roughly 8,000 homeless people on the streets of San Francisco and years, if not decades, of working on this problem. Of course, levels of frustration among voters have been high, and it's likely, or at least part of the reason, you were elected into office. You certainly campaigned on this issue. So we want to dig into your plan, but first, I was wondering if you could just give us some of the top line features of the plan before we ask you about some of the specific elements.
Well, I appreciate that, Ethan. I know we're all frustrated. We've all walked by somebody struggling on our streets, either with homelessness, with their addiction, mental health issues. And the plan really is focused on standing up more shelter beds, 1,500 shelter beds, more mental health beds, more drug treatment beds, making sure that there are options for people. Far too often, you know, our outreach teams are out there, and by the middle of the day, there's no more beds. Our department heads all went out together last week at night, making sure that we're breaking down silos and collaborating, and they found what our outreach team members find, and that is that there just simply aren't enough beds, and really importantly, mental health and drug treatment beds. And so we have to stand up more of those. And that's one of the big pushes for this new plan.
Well, Mayor Lurie, let's talk about the beds. So if we're adding potentially 1,500 shelter beds in 6 months, that's a major lift. So what is the strategy for actually making that happen, especially when so many neighborhoods maybe want to see action on homelessness, but aren't excited about actually having those beds in their neighborhoods, in their communities?
Well, actually, and I have to shout out, the Board of Supervisors has been really incredible. We've had a great working relationship. Of course, you know, people hesitate a little bit, but I think everyone, every supervisor understands, like I understand, that we have a choice. You know, we have people out on the street, and the choice is, do we leave people to suffer and to die on our streets, or do we get them inside? And with a 10-to-1 vote, they passed our fentanyl state of emergency ordinance because they know what I know, and that is that the voters, the residents, our taxpayers have said enough is enough. They want to see results. They want to see accountability. And that means getting people off the street and into beds. And we're going to work with neighborhood groups to get that done. We have line of sight to, you know, close to 700 beds already. And we will plan to stand up more over the next, 5 to 6 months.
And is what the Board of Supervisors passed enough to give you the legal tools to get these shelter beds deployed? Or do you think you're going to need additional legislative action?
No, I think they've given us broad power to get that up and running. I appreciate it. We're keeping them apprised of all of this. We are, you know, working with supervisors. We're working with neighborhood leaders. We're going to look at existing shelter capacity and adding to those. We're looking at some new sites. And it also includes, working to stand up, like I said, those mental health and drug treatment beds. We've applied as a city for state funding through Prop 1 that we all passed in last March, Prop 1 dollars, and we are hoping to have 140 locked beds, I think hopefully coming online in the fall, that will also help do that. But we have the mandate, not only from the voters, but from the Board of Supervisors, and we're going to get the job done.
And Mayor Lurie, when we're talking about additional beds, it feels like an important but still a temporary solution. Are there pathways to more permanent housing for these folks who are experiencing homelessness?
Ethan, it's a great point. This is meant, the 1,500 beds we're talking about, we want to stand them up quickly, and then we want to get people to stability. So that this is not necessarily meaning that we're going to stand up 1,500 beds and they have to stay stood up for 5, 10, 15 years. The idea is that over the next couple years, we get not only these beds built, but we get people then to stability, more permanent supportive housing, more housing placements, more treatment, and then we don't have to maybe keep as many as 1,500 up long term. But we have, you know, going to the more permanent solution topic, housing. We have to build more housing. I know we got Ezra Klein in town this week talking about getting more housing built. I couldn't agree more. We as a city, we as a state, we as a country need to build more affordable housing. And we are focused on getting that job done over the next 4 to 8 years.
Well, certainly a lot we could dig into on the homelessness plan you're talking about that we still have to get to. But I think your point is well supported by a lot of the literature that homelessness is a direct function of not having enough homes built, certainly regionally, but also in San Francisco, the city, of course, under a mandate by the state to build up to 82,000 new housing units over the coming years. So what is your plan to address that need where we have had really just failure for so many years, decades really, in San Francisco in terms of building enough housing to keep up with demand and keep up with population growth?
Yeah, I said on the campaign trail, and I'll say it now, we need housing at all income levels. We need affordable housing. We need market rate housing. We need to build throughout the city. And we are working through our planning director, Rich Hillis, on our zoning map that has been, you know, was going through a process last year, got a little held up because of, you know, the campaign and the politics. And so we are once again going to be outlining our path to not only meet the requirements mandated by the state. And if we don't meet those mandates, the state will come in and take over the process, which we don't want. We want to control our destiny here. But we're working with groups on making sure that we hit the mandate. And more importantly, we stop saying no. And we start saying yes, that we all understand this. I was talking to neighborhood groups in the Mission. They want more housing. I've talked to people on the West Side. They want more housing. We're going to build a lot of housing, hopefully out at Candlestick Point. The power station is getting housing built. This is something that needs to be done throughout our city. And there's already a pipeline, which I'm excited about. So we have to focus all of our attention on saying, as a city and as a state, we need to build more to make housing more affordable.
We're speaking with San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie here on State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the mayor's announced Breaking the Cycle homelessness plan. And Mayor Lurie, a lot we could talk about in terms of building housing, but just to go back to the plan to address homelessness, I know it also calls for restructuring street outreach teams. So can you talk about what, in your view, is not working right now and how your new strategy will lead to better results when it comes to street outreach?
Yeah, Ethan, I don't want to step on the toes. We have a more detailed announcement coming out tomorrow. I hope everybody listening will pay attention. But, you know, I'll tell you how it's been done. And first, our teams who are out there, they do incredible work. But we have 9 different street outreach teams, 5 to 6 different departments overseeing those teams. It's simply not an efficient and effective way of doing it. We're going to streamline that, and we'll have a lot more news to share tomorrow, actually in an announcement. But the most important thing is it's going to be coordinated. We're going to make sure that all of these teams have the support that they need from all of the departments. And more broadly speaking, Ethan, I think the one thing that's been really interesting, you know, I'm new to this role, but something I talked about in the campaign, and we all know we have 58 different departments. They haven't always talked to each other. They work in silos. We are having weekly department head meetings of our large agencies, something that has not been done for a very long time at City Hall. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we have a weekly staff meeting so people can look each other in the eye and say, hey, what do you need help with? And there's more accountability, and people are serving each other that way. And there's no excuses then. There's no one that can say, well, I didn't know that because, well, we brought it up in the meeting that we were all in together. So we're going to do something similar with our outreach teams.
Well, and on that point of just the city bureaucracy, it feels like the governance structure in the city is not really well positioned to deal with these really fundamental challenges. And I appreciate you describing how your management approach is trying to encourage communication among these city bureaucracies. But I know you've also called for consolidating some of these city agencies. Can you walk us through which agencies might be merged or streamlined and how that can really help people get housed faster?
Well, Ethan, let me be clear. We have now four policy chiefs kind of that help work with those 58 departments. So we have, you know, public safety chief and Paul Yep. Alicia is John Baptiste is in charge of public transportation and the environment, and so there's groups that are, you know, flowing well together. So before it was 58 policy chiefs, 58 department heads reporting up to one chief of staff, and now not only do we have an amazing chief of staff in Stacy Slaughter, but we have four policy chiefs as well, and so that helps us communicate better. That helps us collaborate better, and all of that helps not just housing. It helps on public safety. It helps on making sure that SFMTA has got what it needs from other departments. So we're all working much better together. It's going to take us some time, but the first 2.5 months, we've already seen some dividends, and we hope to see that in getting housing built, getting more businesses up and running faster. We have an initiative called Permit SF, where we are trying to consolidate the permitting for small businesses or restaurants or bars getting up and running, so someone can walk into the permit center and have clarity, have shot clocks. And so everyone understands where they are in the process. To date, it was sort of like you turned in your paper and you had to wait for the city to get back to you. Those days are numbered.
Well, Mayor Lurie, let's talk about harm reduction services while we have you, while we're talking about your plan on homelessness. And these are, of course, things like distributing clean needles, foils, other drug-taking supplies. And there seems to be a difference of opinion as to whether these kinds of services are really effective. Are you skeptical of these harm reduction service strategies? Is there evidence to back up whether they can work or not?
Yeah, listen, evidence-based practices, we are going to continue. Needle exchange clearly works. Narcan clearly is saving lives. But here's what I will say. When it comes to fentanyl, the game has changed. We have 2 people a day dying on our streets and in hotels and in SROs in our city right now. The evidence is clear. We have to change course. We have to do something differently. We've been seeing this now for multiple years, and I am committed to changing course when it comes to how do we get people off the street and into those mental health beds, into those drug treatment beds. We have to be compassionate. There is nothing progressive. There's nothing compassionate about the number of people dying of overdose on our streets. And we're going to look at every solution possible that's out there. And we're going to reevaluate things that people that we have been doing as a city for a number of years that is not working. And there are a number of those things.
Well, Mayor Lurie, we just have time for one more question. And I want to ask you about what critics say, which is that San Francisco has tried many versions of these types of strategies before. So what's your response to people who make that criticism? How will this plan be different from past efforts that have tried and frankly not succeeded in San Francisco?
It's the right question. I think people voted for accountability. They voted for change. And that's what we're delivering. You and I have just had a conversation about really important differences in how we're structuring not only my office, but city government and how we react. We're going to have changes in how we do street outreach, which we'll make an announcement about tomorrow, how we deliver services, how we have more mental health, more drug treatment beds, how we get compassionate. But we also have to say the days of walking by somebody and not doing something about it, those days are over. And all I can say is I'm going to be relentless. My administration's going to be relentless on getting people the help that they need. And you have my commitment on that. And I understand people's skepticism. I appreciate that. But it's a new day in San Francisco. We have collaboration with the Board of Supervisors, with our department heads, the likes of which we have not seen for decades in City Hall. So I'm excited. I'm excited about the possibilities ahead for our city, because we are a city, Ethan. We are a city on the rise, and our best days are still in front of us.
Well, San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie, thank you so much for coming back onto State of the Bay, explaining what your plan is on homelessness. We'll stay tuned for that, those announcements tomorrow. Appreciate your time, and thank you again for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Ethan. Have a good night.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we're going to talk about long COVID. Have you or someone you love suffered from it? Join the conversation with us. That's right after the break. So stay with us.
Hello, this is James Cass, Executive Director of KALW. We can all see it. Independent journalism is facing real threats, but we are standing strong. Beginning April 8th, we're inviting you to stand with us to support journalism that pushes back against misinformation and ensures that every voice is heard. We're committed to truth and storytelling that connects our communities, but we can't do it alone, so let's do this together. Invest in KLW, because the future starts now.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be a part of this next conversation. Have you or someone you love experienced long COVID? Tell us your story. What's been helpful in your recovery? What support or resources do you still need? Many long COVID patients struggle to get proper treatment. So what do you wish the medical system understood better about long COVID? You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on our social media channels or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So tonight we're going to talk about a condition that's affecting millions of people, but is still widely misunderstood, and that is long COVID. Now, for many people, a COVID-19 infection comes and goes, but for others, symptoms can persist for months or even years, impacting their ability to work, to care for their families, or even get proper medical treatment. So joining us tonight to help us understand long COVID is Dr. Linda Geng, co-director of the Stanford Long COVID Collaborative. Welcome, Dr. Linda Geng.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. And we also want to welcome Philip Hoover, a screenwriter and North Bay resident who has firsthand experience navigating life with long COVID. Philip, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
So, Dr. Geng, let's start with the basics here. Can you tell us just what exactly is long COVID? I tried to describe it in the intro, but I'm curious how doctors define it, how you explain it when you're asked about what long COVID is.
Sure. And that's a great question, because the definitions from the beginning when we, you know, first recognized the condition has been evolving. And the most recent definition that has been the consensus and is used now is the National Academies of Science and Engineering and Medicine, the NASEM definition that came out in the summer of 2024. And that definition defines long COVID as an infection-associated chronic disease that occurs after COVID and lasts for at least 3 months and can affect one or more organ systems. And I think, you know, what makes it complex is long COVID isn't just one thing. It's really an umbrella term that encompasses many different subtypes of conditions that can occur after COVID. So some of the most common symptoms, but there can be many. The list goes on for literally hundreds of symptoms, but it can include cognitive changes like what people call brain fog, exertional intolerance, where you, if you exert yourself, be it physically or cognitively or others, you crash or feel like you have to pay for it and you really can't tolerate that. Sleep disturbances, among many others. It can be a debilitating illness resulting in loss of function and quality of life. There's some people affected by long COVID who may not be able to work or even leave their home or their bed.
And Dr. Gang, are there any reliable tests for diagnosing long COVID, or is it mostly just based on symptoms that people, patients are reporting?
At this time, unfortunately, we don't have a clinical diagnostic test that's specific for long COVID. That is an urgent need that would really help us be able to, you know, more accurately diagnose and understand long COVID better as well. Right now, it's based on the having a history of COVID and then having these changes in symptoms and health condition.
And Philip, let's bring you into the conversation. We here at State of the Bay came across your story when you published an essay for the New York Times Modern Love column. It was entitled, "I Love You, Please Find Someone Else." It's really kind of a heartbreaking story about the impact that long COVID has had on your life and on your marriage. Can you tell us about your experience with long COVID?
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. Before COVID, I considered myself a healthy 37-year-old. I was working in the TV industry, sometimes up to 12 hours a day. I exercised often. And my wife, Lauren, and I traveled often. We were also talking about starting a family. So all in all, I had a very full, active life. And COVID really changed everything. After my acute infection passed, I knew something was really wrong. I couldn't follow TV shows. This is the brain fog that Dr. Gang was referring to, which was a very cruel irony for a TV writer. Everything was too loud, too bright. The sounds of even cars driving by our house was pretty unbearable. My nervous system really behaved like I was in a war zone. And then one day I exercised, and that's when I found out the hard way that that COVID left me with chronic fatigue syndrome, which is a not uncommon manifestation of long COVID, whose central feature is post-exertional malaise, which is a worsening of symptoms after exertion. So that's when my health really unraveled entirely, and I couldn't leave the house, let alone work. Life became horribly tedious, and I just developed something like 20 new symptoms, and a handful of them are still there nearly 3 years later, although I have made a lot of progress in that time.
And Philip, it is really a heartbreaking story. What is your daily life like now at this point?
I have made significant progress, like I said. So I'm able to work part-time. My wife and I even traveled recently, which would have seemed preposterous 2 years ago. So I'm happy with the improvements I've made, and I'm grateful to be where I am, and I continue to make improvements. But I tell people I kind of feel like I'm still living in sort of a multiverse version of myself, where I don't fully, you know, recognize the body that I'm in, and I'm sort of learning to accept where I'm at and practice self-kindness.
Mm-hmm. And Philip, a lot of people with long COVID often talk about feeling dismissed by the medical system. I'm curious what your medical care and treatment has been like. Have you faced challenges in getting doctors to take these symptoms seriously?
Yes, early on, my medical treatment was pretty horrendous. The medical system in this country is not designed to address complex diseases. It's financially incentivized to maximize profit by maximizing patient turnover. So you have these quick 15-minute appointments when people with chronic illnesses really need longer appointments and a more multi-pronged approach to treatment. Doctors would look at my lab tests and just sort of shrug or smile while they reassured me that my health was fine, which drove me insane because I was, you know, disabled and in a lot of pain. In my essay, I wrote that it felt like being high-fived while drowning, which a lot of long COVID patients reached out to me telling me that line specifically resonated with them. I do have a team of naturopaths and Western medicine doctors now who do keep up with the science and take their time with me, and so I'm really grateful to have that.
We're speaking with Philip Hoover, screenwriter and North Bay resident with firsthand experience navigating life with long COVID, also joined by Dr. Linda Gang, co-director of the Stanford Long COVID Collaborative. Philip, just to stay with you for a bit longer here, I'm curious what has been the hardest part of navigating the medical treatment infrastructure with your long COVID?
I think probably just having doctors take this seriously. This is a disastrous health crisis. It's called a mass disabling event. And it doesn't seem like the medical industry is taking this seriously, like doctors are taking this seriously and treating it like the emergency that it really is. Access. Just say access to treatment.
Has been the most challenging. Well, Dr. Gang, I'm curious, as you're listening to Philip's story, I'm sure you've heard this kind of story before, but what is your reaction to what he's describing about the medical culture, really, the state of medical care, medical diagnosis for people who suffer from long COVID?
Right. And first, Philip, I just want to say thank you for sharing a very personal story and journey and your experiences. It's so invaluable. We learn as a collective community, and we learn so much from everyone's journeys on this. And what the things that you've said also resonate with me as I think about what I've heard from my own patients as well. So it is a struggle. And from someone who, of course, I come from a position where I am very passionate about this area of medicine. I have a general practice background where my focus was on complex illnesses before long COVID existed. So it's an area, just as Philip says, that has been historically neglected in the field of medicine. And our healthcare systems are not set up to help our doctors help the patients who are suffering from these types of conditions. I think we are making progress, and we are, with the recognition of long COVID at such a mass scale, that we know that infection-associated chronic conditions have existed before COVID, and they will continue to exist. And this is a great area of need. And I think the first and foremost, most important thing is for patients to know that they can be cared for by somebody, even if you don't have all the answers, but that they are believed and validated. And I think that's the first step we can do as clinicians and doctors.
Well, I just want to remind listeners, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about long COVID. I'm very pleased to be joined by Dr. Linda Gang, co-director of the Stanford Long COVID Collaborative, and Philip Hoover, a screenwriter and North Bay resident who has firsthand experience navigating life with long COVID. And we'd love to hear from you as well. The phone lines are open. Have you or someone you love experienced long COVID? We want to hear your story. We want to find out from you what's been helpful in your recovery. What support or resources do you feel like you still need? And also, what do you wish the medical system understood better about long COVID, especially given what we were just talking about, Philip's struggle to get better medical attention for this condition? The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with your stories, comments, questions at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And Philip, to go back to you and what you've been dealing with long COVID, is there anything, whether it's support from loved ones or certain treatments or lifestyle changes, that's helped you manage your system, your symptoms, I mean, even beyond what the medical system has to offer?
I think the main thing that's helped me is probably time. It's been about 2.5 years now since I got COVID. I have just made significant improvements over that time period. Other things that have helped have been an anti-inflammatory diet. I know that I've learned that much of the immune system resides in the gut, so addressing gut health is really important. One of the biggest things is learning to pace. So for people who have chronic fatigue syndrome and long COVID, pacing is a big management strategy and tool that we use daily to manage our symptoms. So that's essentially to us means not overexerting, learning not to overdo it, which is actually really hard to do in the culture we live in, where your value is tied to how much you produce. So there's a sort of a lot of, there's a big learning curve there. Breathwork and meditation have also been really helpful. And therapy is probably one of the biggest tools and this is another thing that I wish more people knew about long COVID and is a crisis that's not being adequately addressed, is the psychological devastation of becoming chronically ill essentially overnight. It has enormous impacts on patients.
And Philip, I'm curious also, just along the lines perhaps of sort of the mental health aspect of this, is have you found support online or otherwise, support groups, ways that people can talk to you, maybe experiencing similar things or have, success stories that they can share with you?
I try to be active on social media with various long COVID groups and advocacy groups and do my own advocacy through my writing. I also have a really wonderful support group that I meet with every week online. And it's really relieving because there's not a lot of catching up to do. We all know just how incredibly tough this is to navigate, and we can be real about it and also laugh and have some fun too and root for each other. So we've all become really great friends, and I feel lucky to have found them. And I encourage anyone who's experiencing long COVID to try to find a support group if they can.
And Dr. Gang, just to think about this from the medical perspective, when you hear Philip's story, how does this compare to the patients that you're seeing in your clinic or in your studies?
It really resonates with me from what I've heard from other patients as well. I will say long COVID is, you know, different for different people. It is a very heterogeneous condition. So one person's experience may be very different from somebody else's, but I think there's a common theme. And what Philip said, you know, reminds me of a theme that I often hear from patients, which I don't feel like myself. It's like almost an identity crisis, right? The life that they used to live and lead and function is no longer the life that and who they are anymore. And that, in terms of just coping and that shift and trauma, essentially, and having to deal with that is significant on top of the underlying biology and the medical issues. And so there's just a lot to have the care that's needed, right? And Philip also mentioned, you know, the sort of multidimensional, multidisciplinary whole person care that's really needed to take care of somebody with a complex illness like long COVID. So you really need that teamwork and a care team to be able to address all the things and all the layers that occur with this.
And we have an email question in. Rose in Berkeley wants to know, do we know why some people develop long COVID while others fully recover? Dr. Gang, can you answer that question?
Well, that's definitely an area of research that we're trying to better understand. And I want to say that long COVID can affect anyone. I think that's really important, no matter age, race, sex, et cetera. There are a variety of factors that have been identified that can increase somebody's risk for long COVID. We're still trying to identify similarly what are the factors that can help somebody heal and recover. But for some people, it is a chronic condition. Again, can last for years, and we don't know for how much longer as well. It could be a lifelong illness, and we hope to find the cure for that. There are also some leading ideas about what causes long COVID based on the research in the past few years. But obviously the research is still very active and more needs to be done. But things like chronic inflammation, Philip had mentioned anti-inflammatory diet, you know, that's really based on the idea that we have this, you know, immune activation that happens when you get the infection. And then after the infection's gone, it should calm down, right? The fire should cool down. But in some people, that may still be smoldering or lingering, and that can cause a lot of issues, symptoms, and damage. And there are other things like microbiome, like Philip has mentioned, and maybe persistent viral particles. There's also been some research to point that direction. Mitochondria, which is the battery of the cell, maybe relating to energy levels. So these aren't mutually exclusive, and different people may be more or less susceptible depending on which pathways may be dysregulated or abnormal after COVID. And this can vary from person to person.
Dr. Gang, in terms of treatment, generally speaking, what options are currently available for patients like Philip suffering from long COVID?
This is an area of urgent need. So as of today, there are no approved therapies to treat long COVID, meaning the FDA hasn't approved a specific intervention, drug or otherwise, to treat long COVID. But that's not to say there aren't management strategies. And these are typically individually tailored, just as Philip was mentioning, depending on the symptoms and the needs of that patient. And as you can imagine, it's a complex discussion because someone's symptoms may be a few, it could be dozens. And so it really needs to be tailored to the individual, but it addresses that holistic picture, or it should, from a person-centered care, including if they have shortness of breath or if they have sleep disturbance, having a multidisciplinary team to target some of those, and then think about potentially management of those the biological pathways that may be at play as well. But at this time, we really need large, well-designed clinical trials to definitively prove that something works well for long COVID and different subtypes of long COVID. So it's urgently needed.
Well, Dr. Gang, is this underway now, this kind of research? It's, as you said, it's badly needed, or is this something that, you know, is potentially another casualty of some of the federal cutbacks to our scientific research?
Yeah, it definitely has been underway, but I think we're just at the beginning. You know, this is a critical phase where we're doing the ramp up. And Stanford has led several of those studies. We led the first trial testing in the world, an antiviral called Paxlovid for long COVID. We didn't find a benefit in that study, but there were several other studies that followed. And I think this is an important area. And then we're also part of the NIH-sponsored, what's called RECOVER Initiative, that's also running several clinical trials. And we're part of that right now, doing a couple trials, and a couple trials just wrapped up. And we're just at the beginning. We're just starting. And this is a critical time where resources and funding are needed to continue that momentum, because we really need to continue making that progress and find that cure.
Dr. Gang, what treatments or interventions then do you typically recommend based on how much they're helping people? I mean, are you seeing specific treatments that are being researched or trialed that seem very promising?
Yeah, it goes back to some of the major models of biological pathways of, you know, what might be contributing to somebody's symptoms. So a lot of the things that, you know, we tested, for example, was an antiviral, and that gets at the hypothesis that there may be lingering virus particles that could be contributing to somebody's symptoms. So we try to address that and target that. Other pathways include the immune system. So there can be chronic inflammation and immune dysregulation. So therefore, the natural kind of agents would be used in a large category include anti-inflammatory agents, immune modulators. So these types of things are being tested and tried as well.
And Dr. Gang, we heard from Philip earlier that he felt like he was really left behind. And other patients have said similar things when it comes to the research and medical care for long COVID. What do you say to sort of medical colleagues, your fellow healthcare colleagues, about what they should be doing to better address this condition of long COVID?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I definitely hear Philip, and I think this is something that many of our patients have experienced along their journey. And it's tough because there aren't enough, for example, specialized long COVID centers like ours around the country to be able to serve everybody. And what we need to, what we are trying to do at Stanford is actually, we have a program called REACH, which is Resources and Education to Advance Community Health. And that, our model, and we're trying to study this, is can we deliver care to where patients are? Because there are just not enough long COVID clinic like specialists who can provide that care. And so if we do training and education and raise awareness, because number one is for doctors to, first of all, know that long COVID exists. Number two, to know that it's real. And then number three, they want to know, what can I do about it? How can I diagnose it and how can I treat it? And of course, it's rapidly evolving. And they're busy with so many other things too, right? They're trying to take care of primary health care, all the tasks that they have to do in a, just like Philip said, 15-minute visit. How do you do all that? So we need quick, easy, and accessible tools that clinicians can use, and they don't have to be experts in the condition, but we need to develop those tools. And that's part of the research that we do. We need to educate and train. And I think as we raise awareness about the understanding of the biology, it legitimizes the condition and removes that stigma and helps make progress. And then we, as a specialist in long COVID, you know, we need to be out there. We need to, you know, teach and train and say, okay, if somebody presents like XYZ, then you have XYZ options and care, so that clinicians also know that it's not just, you know, okay, so if they have long COVID, there's nothing I can do. There are things that can be done. But the first step, like going back to earlier in the conversation, the first step is believing the patient. You know, oftentimes, like Philip said, I want to echo a lot of what he says, but the lab tests that we currently have available are not going to show much or may not show much. That doesn't mean that something isn't going on and that something isn't real. It just means we don't have the test right now accessible to us right now to, you know, help find a biomarker. But I think if we continue the research, you know, we will get there. And in the meantime, we do what we can for our patients.
You're listening to Dr. Linda Gang, co-director of the Stanford Long COVID Collaborative. We also have Philip Hoover, screenwriter and North Bay resident with firsthand experience navigating life with long COVID. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is State of the Bay on KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. We only have a few minutes left, but the phone lines are still open at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255 if you have questions or comments, you can also email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Dr. Geng, I know you have to leave us at just a couple minutes. Philip, we'd love to keep you on for a few extra minutes beyond that, but we have a couple email questions I wanted to read to you, Dr. Geng. I think they're both really directed for you. First question from Eli, asking if long COVID is related to Epstein-Barr, and are there other mental health repercussions that are typically related, like depression and anxiety? So maybe I'll have you answer that first one, and then I'll have another one for you right after that.
Sure. Yes, there's been fascinating research that's been done about Epstein-Barr and its relationships to certain autoimmune conditions like multiple sclerosis and other conditions. And I think this is a really a rich area of investigation. And a lot of research is being done to think about EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, which is another type of virus, and how that can impact chronic illnesses like long COVID or other infection-associated chronic conditions. And there's been some research studies that suggest that there may be a role for that. It's still being researched, and I think there's more work, so stay tuned. But it's the relationship is complex. We think about one virus and then its impact, but that there's a whole microbiome and virome, if you will, if there's bacteria and other organisms that live within us and may be dormant and may be reactivated. And so these may play a role, but I think this is an area of lots of active investigation, and we'll have to see the direct relationship.
Another email from James, just very quickly. Have there been any studies about whether people who are fully vaxxed obtained long COVID less than those who may not have been fully vaccinated?
Yes. There's been quite a body of research that has been suggesting that the vaccination can be protective against developing long COVID. So there's been actually systematic reviews and meta-analysis looking at large body of data suggesting that.
Mm-hmm. And I know you got to jump, but any signs of hope? What are you most optimistic about for those suffering from long COVID?
Yeah, so half a decade has passed, since the pandemic started. We have made a lot of progress in understanding long COVID. And I think, I'm inspired by the dedication of patients and doctors and researchers. And if we continue to prioritize this and recognize that it's an ongoing, important public health issue and clinical issue, and patients are continuing to suffer, that we continue as a collective village to tackle this. And if we keep this momentum going, with resources and funding, I believe we will find a cure. So I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful.
Well,
thank you for having
me. Yeah, Dr. Linda Geng, co-director of the Stanford Long COVID Collaborative. Thank you for joining us. I know Linda had to jump, but Philip Hoover, screenwriter, North Bay resident with firsthand experience of life with long COVID, thank you for standing by as we had a number of medical questions for Dr. Geng. And Philip, I wanted to ask you from your perspective, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges that people with long COVID are facing today, and what do you think needs to change the most to try to address those challenges?
That's a really good question. The mass disabling event that long COVID represents is wildly disproportionate to the amount of funding, research, and awareness that goes into it. So we need a lot more of all of those things. And I think now more than ever, patients of all kinds, not just long COVID, are pretty terrified right now of what this Trump administration means for our futures, when they seem so determined to gut scientific research and funding of all kinds. Just recently, they cut the advisory committee on long COVID, and the chronic fatigue research program at Columbia University was shut down due to lack of funding. It's one of the only centers of its kind in the United States, so that seems disastrous for us. So we need leaders who are willing to fight for us. We have very few in office who can even say the words long COVID out loud. We also need doctors in our corner, and I'm happy to hear that Dr. Geng and her colleagues are working so hard on trials and treatments. We need friends and family who are willing to fight for us too. I think I speak on behalf of this community when I say that we feel abandoned by a government that largely pretends we don't exist and feel left behind by a society that has moved on and wants to deny the reality that this illness presents.
And Philip, we're almost out of time, but just last question for you. Is there anything you really want to let listeners know about long COVID? I mean, you just delivered a number of really important messages there, but anything else you really want to communicate about what it's like having to live with long COVID?
I think it's important for people to know just how devastating and how devastating this is, how extremely people are suffering, and how desperate we are for treatment. Some people are confined to their beds. You know, most people who get long COVID were previously healthy, myself included. So this can blindside you and change your life overnight. People should know that I think each COVID infection increases your risk of long COVID. So a third infection might not do it, but a fourth one could be the one to disable you. The damage from COVID is also cumulative. That's for everyone, not just long haulers. So it raises your risk of heart attack, stroke, diabetes. So normalizing reinfection and not taking basic precautions to mitigate risk, I think it's going to be looked back on as a huge public health failure. And yeah, the last thing I want to say is we just need people to listen to us, to be our allies and to believe us and to treat long COVID with the urgency that this disease requires.
Well, Philip Hoover, television and screenwriter, just want to thank you for sharing your personal experience and also, of course, wish you all the best in recovery from long COVID. But thank you so much for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Thank you for having me on.
And for links to the long COVID support organizations, some of which mentioned here, you can see our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. Coming up after the break, you're going to hear my interview with Ramon Ramos Alayo of Cuba Caribe. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Hanat Baba, host of Cross Currents. If you hear the news, you know public media and independent journalism are under threat. But here at KALW, we also want you to know that we are standing strong. Starting April 8th, we're inviting you to stand with us to support journalism that pushes back against misinformation. The reality is we can't do it alone. So join us. April 8th, invest in KALW Public Media. And let's grow this thing together.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind, and tonight I'm thrilled to be joined by Ramon Ramos Alayo, the visionary behind the Cuba Caribe Festival of Dance and Music, happening right here in the Bay Area starting on March 28th. Ramon is the creative force behind this extraordinary festival, which celebrates the rich talents of artists from Cuba and the Caribbean. And I'm excited to have him here tonight to share more about the festival, its impact, and what audiences can look forward to this year. So, Ramon, welcome to State of the Bay.
Welcome for having me. Thank you for having me.
So, Ramon, Cuba Caribe is now in its 22nd year. What inspired you to start this festival, and how has it evolved over the years?
Well, what inspired me to have the Cuba Caribe Festival is like, we have so many musicians, artists, visual artists, and dancers here in the Bay Area from Cuba, and we were not exposed to share our work, in different places. And one of the things that I really wanted to have is how we can unify and have everybody together in one place every year. And you know, we started doing that with having different Cuban dance company and groups. And after that, we expanded to be more open to the Caribbean, because the Caribbean and Cuba, we share almost the same culture, even if we're practicing a different religion and music and dance. You know, it's all come from almost the same base, you know. And that's why we're trying to unify the Caribbean in one place here in the Bay Area.
And how has the festival changed? What was it like in the first year compared to now? Anything new you've added over the years or changed?
Yeah, I mean, we expanded. You know, when we started, it was only one weekend. Now we do 2 weekends. And also now we have, we do lectures. We have classes on the festival. So before we started very small, and now it's like, you know, it's bigger.
And I know the theme for this year's festival is A Fire Within. How does this theme resonate with you personally as an artist? And what does it mean for the festival this year?
For me, it's more personal. For me, I want every choreographer to come out with something that have really inside, so to share with the audience, you know, what is inspiring them. So for me, it's more about what do they have to share to the community that is really impacted right now in the Bay Area.
And I know you have a passion for dance. Can you talk about what inspired you about dance, how you originally became so passionate about it, and how that has translated throughout your career?
Well, I mean, I come from Cuba dancing when I was 11 years old, and I graduated when I was 19 years old in Havana in the National School of Arts. And after that, I started dancing with different companies in Cuba. I traveled all over the world with the company that used to dance in Cuba. After that, I was invited to come here to the U.S. to perform and teach. That was in 1996. And we did a lot of workshops. We did a lot of performances here in the Bay Area. I mean, we traveled the whole country and here in the U.S. And I went back to Cuba. And in 1997, I came to teach and perform. And that's when they decided to stay here in the U.S. And that's with Robert Moses. I danced with Kim Epifano, Sarah Gentleman. So many dance companies, Joanna Heggett. And what inspired me, when I got here to the U.S., they didn't have, the dancing here was not that strong that the way I was dancing in Cuba. Because it gave me another way to dance in the U.S.
And Ramon, I know that this Cuba Caribe Festival brings together a number of different elements, including folkloric, contemporary, popular types of dance expressions of Afro-Caribbean dance and music. How do you go about picking the themes and the types of music and dance you want to feature in the festival?
Well, we come out with the theme for the festival, and I choose company that we wanna work with. And this year I asked two dance company, because those companies they've been working with us for a long, long time. One is Los Lupeños de San Jose. I really enjoy their folklore. I really love the tradition, and I always, it's been like so many years I have them participating in the festival. And the other one is Herencia Guantanamera. It's a dance company. They live here from the, it's a, for the Cuban music and dance in one region of Cuba, Guantanamo, where they come out with Guantanamo is in Cuba is one of the most traditional, yeah, the most traditional folklore music in Cuba.
All right, well, I wanted to ask, what can audiences expect to see and experience at the festival this year? Any highlights you can share in advance?
It's going to be a very mixed program with different groups representing their culture. We have Puerto Rico. We have people from Haitian. So those are different groups. Also, we have master classes that are Cuban. And also, when the pandemic started, I went to Cuba and I made a movie there about how the Cuban dancers were surviving. And that's one of the big highlights that for the festival. My dance company is not performing, but I'm presenting a movie. So the highlight for me is, yeah, is the movie, is the classes, the mix of different programs on the festival.
And I know the festival also pays tribute to Bobby Cespedes. Can you tell us about her for listeners who aren't familiar with Bobby and why it was important to celebrate her contribution specifically?
Well, Bobby Cespedes for me is like the mother of the Cuban folklore and music. She's the matrix where everybody can go and ask questions. She's the matrix of, she's one of the first ones to come here to the Bay Area and establish herself as a musician, as a santera. And we want to acknowledge her because she's been part of Cuba Caribe for many, many years. And I think she's, for me, she's my, like the mother of the Cuban culture here in the Bay Area.
I'm glad you can pay tribute to her contributions. And I also just want to end by asking, looking ahead, what are your hopes for the future of Cuba Caribe, both as a festival, as an organization? What comes next for you after the festival?
Well, for me as a artistic director, I would love to see more Cuban groups, more Cuban artists coming from straight from Cuba here to the U.S. to share, you know, share what we, how to say, lo que nosotros sabemos hacer bien, what we know how to do better is sharing our culture. But one of the things that really, you know, hope in the future for the Cuba Caribe is, you know, we can get more support from the government. That's one of my hopes.
Well, Ramon, we're certainly looking forward to the festival. And I just want to thank you for sharing more about your history with dance and about the festival and what audiences can look forward to seeing it. So thank you so much. And thanks for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, the Cuba Caribe Festival kicks off on March 28th and runs through April 4th. For tickets and more details, visit www.cubacaribe.org. We'll put that on our website. We hope you check it out.
Thank you.
Nada. El tiempo ha pasado y nada. Ni 20 años pudieron matar lo que adentro estaba.